Okay, turn the time over to Ray, and then when he's done, we'll turn the time to Nanette, and then you can ask your questions when they're both done.
Thank you, Sue. Sue's been great to work with. I appreciate the opportunity she's given me to speak here today. I think you're really lucky as an organization to have somebody like her. She's so energetic and competent, and it's a great asset for an organization like this. I'm also really grateful to be on the same two-person panel with Nanette and look forward to her comments after mine. I guess I'd like to begin tonight by maybe sharing with you this afternoon by sharing with you a pet theory of mine. And that pet theory is that you can tell a lot about a person by the kind of movies and books that person currently likes to watch and read. So if there's anything of any validity to that particular supposition, maybe you could learn a little bit more about me by sharing a couple of my favorites. Now, one of my favorite movies came out a few years ago, is entitled Pleasantville. I'm getting some oohs and ahs, so I'm assuming some of you have seen that by now, either in the theater or in the cable. In fact, I noticed on my cable in Bountiful this week it was on again, and I always rewatch it a lot of times. But for those of you that might not have, it's a story about a small town with a group of men who have come up with all kinds of rigorous rules based on a repressive and narrow-minded moral dogma. And that just doesn't, after a while, those town folks, a few of them at first and then more and more, start saying, hey, we're going to start demanding a little bit more freedom of expression and thought. And it's really kind of neat how they do it in the movie, because as these people start to regain this freedom, the people and all the surroundings around them change from black and white, as many of you are aware, to a brilliant color. And I thought that was a tremendous representation by who made that movie, because I was touched when that happened. And maybe that'll give you just a little bit of an idea of what's happened to me before and after what I'm about to share with you this afternoon. My favorite book, currently at least, is entitled Infidel. And it's an autobiography by a Somalian by the name of Ayan Hirsi Ali, who has courageously fought herself free from the barbaric Muslim doctrine, especially as it relates to the role of women in that particular religion. At least to her it did. And she's gone all the way, in fact, from being a very devout Muslim to all the way to an atheist right now. And that's it's a little bit farther than I'm willing to go at this present time. But I so admire her for her relentless and objective search for the truth in spite of great danger that she's faced, first in Somalia, then in surrounding countries, then up to the Dutch area, then over to the United States, where she's on the East Coast right now, where her life is in danger for all that time because of what she's been saying, and is still in great danger even up to this day. For those of you that have seen this movie and have read that book, it should give you an idea about my present state of mind after approximately 13-year investigative effort from a very active Mormon until I guess I would categorize myself now as a firm agnostic. I might, just as an aside, I might tell you that when you come out of the closet as an agnostic, you better be ready for a little good-natured ribbing, which I have from my golf buddies and others. But, for example, I would doubt if there's anybody here that hasn't heard this joke, but this is the one I get all the time, of what you get when you combine an agnostic, a dyslexic, and an insomniac. For those of you that might not have heard that, you get somebody that stays up all night wondering if there's a dog. I think maybe there's some of you that didn't hear that, but. Or what happens to agnostics when they die? Do they perhaps go to the great perhaps? Or agnostics are known to leaving all possibilities open as opposed to atheist and theist. And, of course, it all depends on what the proof shows later on if they're going to buy it or not, but they're always open. So, like I just noticed another one on a bumper sticker the other day that says, let's see, what did it say? It says, "What if the hokey pokey is what it's all about?" Possibility, not very likely, but a possibility. I mean, wouldn't that be nice if you just your left foot in, your left foot out? And then you could find the ultimate truth. That would be an easy way to do it. But anyway, I make this point because I really covet this kind of humor. I like a sense of humor. And in fact, if they would ask me to come here today and say, "You can only leave one thought from your 63 years on this earth," what would it be? I would say, let's try to develop a sense of humor, because I am firmly convinced with this crazy world we have with all the ups and downs, that that's an important instrument in trying to get through here in one piece. And so take it for what it's worth, the 63 years, that'd be my number one choice of any advice I might give. Briefly now, a short version of my biography as it relates to my religious experience. I was born in Denver, Colorado, grew up in Boulder, Colorado in 1943. My dad came from a long line of Swedish Lutherans who migrated into the United States, into Iowa, and finally back up into Colorado in the farming area. My mother can trace her roots directly back to the last group to come in to the first year into the Salt Lake Valley in 1847. My dad converted not too long after they were married, and we moved to Salt Lake City, where, along with my three younger sisters, we became very much involved in all aspects of the LDS Church. My dad worked out at Hill Air Force Base, so we had opportunity to travel, and that's what I ended up doing for all of my high school years. Ninth and tenth grade I spent at an air base in just outside Casablanca, Utah, Nursur Air Base in North Africa. And 11th and 12th grade I spent in Wiesbaden, Germany. Because of this, in both locations for 4 years there, we were able to only attend small branches of the church, very few members, not very many my age. And because of that, most of my friends that I had during that formative four-year period were non-members of the church. After returning to Utah, I attended 1 year at BYU, and then for financial reasons moved back home with my parents in Bountiful, where I eventually ended up graduating from the University of Utah. And I was a member for most of that time at University of Utah with a fraternity, Sigma Phi Epsilon, and not very conducive to going to church. And by the time it came time for me to go on a mission, I was inactive, probably the best way to say it, just inactive. And I remember my dad wanting me to sit down with him, and I think the conversation went on for about half hour, maybe an hour, and he wanted to know what my problem was. And I don't remember much about this. I only remember one thing I talked about, and I said, "I just don't think it's right that God would keep on pressing everybody to keep on worshiping him. I said, "I think that would be kind of egotistical, and it just doesn't make a lot of sense to me." So that's kind of a funny thing to remember. I know we spoke a lot more things, but I just remember that one thing. But anyway, as a result, I'm sure he got to the authorities, because I never got the mission call. My wife, Janelle, was also inactive, probably because I took her to some of those fraternity parties. And we were married outside the temple. We were living at a University Village when another friend of mine, who was my best friend, probably still is today, was also living there and helped coax us to go to a program that they had at that time. Some of you might recall, it was called Project Temple. And it was a great guy. It was on Sunday afternoon for about an hour. We really enjoyed the instructor. He was a tremendous fellow. We looked forward, because he was kind of funny too. We looked forward to doing that. And what he would have us do, any of you that might have been through that program, is that at the end of one each week you would do something you hadn't been doing to try to qualify yourself to get back in shape. You know, like the first week you might all of a sudden, okay, we're going to agree this week to start paying a full tithing. Next week, no more pina coladas, et cetera, et cetera. Until after the end of that 6-month period, we had qualified to enter the temple, and we did that on our first anniversary. I have to say right now that I did not feel inspired that first experience in the temple, nor did I feel even a little bit comfortable. But I figured, well, that's just my problem. I'm still new at this stuff, and I need to kind of go along to get along. And besides, my family was so proud of what we'd been able to accomplish in the Project Temple, so I just went along with it. I developed an overall, let's put this first. Almost anything I've ever joined, I've attempted to give it my full support and effort, whatever that might be, at least the best that I could do. And I've never been comfortable with a lukewarm approach. And I wasn't any more comfortable than that when I reactivated into the church. In fact, after that point, I never had much respect for fellow members who were kind of tepid in their help in getting done what needed to get done. We moved from San Francisco back to Kanab, Utah, back to Los Angeles, to Dallas, out to East Texas, to Tyler, Texas, back to Salt Lake, over to Ogden, and then retired in southern Utah where we lived in Hurricane, and I worked a one-man resident agency out of the St. George office down there in the FBI. So that had included 5 years with the Department of Interior and then a 27-year career with the FBI as a special agent. Now, I can only say this from what I really believe. I believe I accepted and magnified the best that I could every calling. I can't remember one that I refused when they came to me, every calling that I was ever offered. I obeyed the vast majority of the commandments as much as I think a human can, with the failings that we all have, you know, a little bit. And I developed an overall unshakable testimony, even though certain things continued to bother me under the surface a little bit. I discounted them, thinking there must going to be a logical explanation come along someday. As I look back right now, I have to just summarize and say I was primarily going on blind faith in all of this. I just had blind faith that it would all work out. I was a bishop's counselor several times. I was a bishop once. I was on the Stake High Council. I was head of the Stake Missionary Program, just to mention a few of the positions that I had. And to be honest, I was just too busy trying to inspire others to spend much time with any lingering doubts I might have, working more than full-time and often way more than full-time as a special agent, and then having very demanding positions in the church, plus trying to help my wife raise our five young daughters that were only 2 years apart, each of them. Didn't leave much time for introspection or self-doubt. With about 5 years left until retirement, about 1993, I guess, and most of the daughters out of the house by then, I guess what my problem was, I just had too much time to think all of a sudden. And the things that had bothered me seemed to amazingly just all surface simultaneously. I had never felt comfortable with the temple ever. I'd gone a lot, as an example, more than anything. I never experienced what I thought I should experience with priesthood power in my positions, and yet I thought I should have deserved that if that would have been a real power, the priesthood power. I felt most of it I could have done without, just on my own. I was never comfortable about the blacks not holding the priesthood. I was never comfortable about polygamy in the older days of the church. I'd even become suspicious about the power of prayer, and I was beginning to wonder really if I was just having kind of a one-way conversation with myself. I had been working con men as part of my assignment. I did everything in one-man RAs, but part of my assignment with the FBI was working con men, which I had several interesting cases. And I had finally realized that I had never subjected Joseph Smith to the same standard of investigative effort that I had done these con men. And it came to me that this is something that I wanted to do. This was something that I needed to do. Now, my first step in this whole process was to tell my bishop, because I had been quite active in the ward in a lot of positions. And I told him I couldn't in good conscience accept any more positions, and generally what was bothering me at that point. He agreed not to make a big deal out of it as long as I didn't express it to other members of the ward and risk poisoning my thoughts with the other members, which I agreed to do. So we kind of came to a mutual agreement where he allowed me to remain a member of the ward choir, which I was glad he did because I really enjoyed that, and I miss it now. I decided to begin my investigation. Well, no, I just told you that step. I think I missed the first step. The first step before I went to the bishop was to tell Janelle. Wow. And I was really concerned because I had, as a bishop, I had counseled couples, and I'd known other bishops that counseled couples where one of them was doing what I was doing right now. And it had resulted in all kinds of family strife, alienation, and in several instances, divorce. And I didn't want to know part of anything like that. I love my wife. So I was really wondering how that was going to work out. And although I don't think she has ever yet completely been at ease with the magnitude of my change, all the way to an agnostic at this point, her initial reaction that day when we were on a walk and I confronted her with this was a reasonable degree of acceptance and even some agreement. For example, for the first time, we never talked to each other about it, but for the first time, we both admitted that we had never, either one of us, been comfortable with the temple ceremony from the beginning. Even after the changes, it made it a lot more tenable. At that moment, I can recall feeling a palatable sense of relief because that was my major concern. Then I went to the bishop. Next step, I decided to begin my investigation in earnest and decided to use my best friend, who was the one in University Village who had got me interested in Project Temple, to act as a kind of sounding board. So I would snail mail him my concerns a couple at a time, and he would snail mail me back his responses, trying to think of everything he can where I was maybe missing the boat. And we had word processors at that time, but no access, no ability to do email at that time. So that's why we had to snail mail it back and forth a little bit. But this went on for years and got kind of testy at times. And it got to where eventually it stressed our friendship to the point where we had to discontinue doing that. But I just wanted to make sure, because he was so smart, he was much smarter than I was, that I wasn't making some kind of terrible mistake or that I wasn't having some kind of midlife crisis and that what I was reasoning and coming up to made some kind of sense. Now, my dad had passed away by this time, and I tried to approach my mother and one sister, but they didn't want to hear specifically what my concerns might be. And it became painfully obvious to me that they just were uncomfortable, and so I decided to not pursue that any further, cause them any more grief with that, and I still haven't to this day. I didn't discuss it with our daughters, fearing I'd mess them up somehow. I mean, how can you be going so far one way, and then all of a sudden their dad is going the opposite way? What are you all about? You know, you're confusing us. So I didn't discuss it with them at that point. And besides, at that early stages, I really didn't know how it was going to work out. And so I didn't want to say anything prematurely. One of the first actions I took was to quit wearing my garments, which felt almost as weird as the first time that I'd put them on in the first place. You know, a habit is really a funny thing when you go that many years with anything. One of the things I could not change, I'm going to admit it to you here this afternoon, I could not change was being an avid BYU football and basketball fan. And I can't, still can't. In fact, they got a game tonight, but that's beside me. They got to win that one tonight, but through this entire process, I've been called a hypocrite. Janelle has tried to tell me time and time again, Ray, you cannot be an agnostic and be a BYU sports fan at the same time. And then she always had this little thing on the end, especially when you graduated from the University of Utah. But my response is guilty. Guilty as charged. Can't help it. My remarks before the great agnostic bar of justice in the sky, if there ends up to be such a thing, would be, I just couldn't help myself. I was cougarized beyond my ability to repent. Actually, I've got nothing against the football team, the basketball team. I've got nothing against any other member of the church. My problem is with Joseph Smith. He's the one that started all these things that are giving me all the problems. Some of the best people I've ever known and still do are active members of the church. Much of my family, who I greatly respect and love, are active members of the church. It would be hypocritical on my part to take out my misgivings on well-meaning and active Mormons. After all, I was exactly where they are for a better part of my adult life, so it would kind of be like criticizing me in that position, which I wouldn't have appreciated. I found that most Mormons are sincere and that they have no intention to deceive on their part. It's more they're the ones being deceived, but there are a few, I'm sure, that are causing that, but not them often. With no intention of publishing a book, I conducted my investigation, setting out my concerns in the form of a book anyway, because it was the easiest way for me to organize my thoughts. I had a chapter for each of my concerns. Now, a couple of things I did in the book, in that research, in those chapters, was that I only included what I wanted to find. I wanted to just take those concerns that I felt that a very active member of the church would actually be something that would bother them, which I considered myself to be. In other words, I didn't want to have the kind of criticisms that never bothered me. For example, one of the ones that comes to mind is the who's bothered by the claim that Mormons aren't Christian. To me, that's a softball criticism. It never did bother me. It wouldn't bother me today if I was active. We might have expanded Christ's role, but the foundation of the church was still centered around Jesus Christ. Go ahead and criticize all you want. That's nothing that's going to bother most active members of the church. What I wanted to do is take those things that really did bother me and restrict it to those things as I knew would bother most people, even if they were active members of the church. I also wanted to simplify the concerns, that you didn't have to be a religious scholar to decide the validity of those concerns, although I love religious scholarism, whatever, because I read. Art Vanek was very great speaker today, and I really appreciate his comments, and I'm going to probably get a copy of his book because that's one of my current areas of interest. But anyway, what I wanted to do is make this easy. And why did I do that? Well, I guess it's because of my experience in court throughout the years. And I found that when we had expert witnesses on both sides of the aisle, I would even get confused because I didn't know really what either one of them was talking about, and they both sounded pretty good to me. And so I found the best attorneys were the ones that were able to explain their theory so that the least smart juror on the panel could understand it. And that's what I kind of wanted to do, that you could do it just with common sense that everybody has and logic, and you wouldn't have to know a lot of science or anything to be able to understand what was bothering me. Now, I never thought about questioning Christianity at this point, never. I just assumed I wasn't going to be a Mormon, but I was going to be a Christian. And that stayed that way until one time I was snail mailing back and forth with my friend, and we were talking about polygamy, and he brought up the point. He said, listen, I don't know what you got this deal on polygamy. What's bothering about you? Look at the Bible. You know, some of God's best people in the Bible were okay with polygamy, evidently, through in a lot of the history of the Bible. And then it struck me. Was I giving Christianity a free ride, too, just like I had been doing for Joseph Smith? Had I possibly been blindly indoctrinated about the Bible just as I had the Book of Mormon? That resulted in my second investigative effort into the concerns about the Christian dogma. Now, this time I decided to take just a little bit different approach and create my chapters basically on just taking a concern and then not going any further with it, But just off the top of my own mind, which probably isn't all that great, but anyway, off the top of my own mind, say what bothered me about that. Without using an relying on what other people might have said about it before. So I'm sure other people have said similar things, but what I wanted to do with this was just say, this is just on you now, Holt. What is it in your gut that tells you is a problem with this particular doctrine or that doctrine? So that second, what ended up to be a second book, has very little bibliography as opposed to the Book of Mormon, which you cannot explain. Mormonism, very complex. Unless you use a few references, it's just impossible. But I may be wrong, but I think what eventually ended up as chapter 17 through 25 of volume 1 of Bothersome Christian Doctrine is unique and may even be original because I took that approach. I have never read anything else about anybody that approached it like I did on this one. And that is that the Christian concept of a final judgment is indefensible and is never going to happen, no matter if there ends up being a God or not. Just can't happen. Common sense makes it impossible for a Christian judgment to ever, ever happen. Volume 2 ended up being the agnostic view of bothersome Mormon doctrine, and it was simply Volume 2 because it took me longer to do than the Christian one I did first, so that ended up being Volume 1. Why did I decide to publish both these books when I hadn't had that intention when I started? In a series, along with possible other future books that take the next major religion in order, I was thinking of Muslim. I don't know if I dare do that now. I might skip that one and go to Hindu or something because I don't want to be like I.N. Hersey Ali. But anyway, why would I decide to do that and publish it is because I think the agnostic position, and again, I know many of you won't be agnostic. You might be ex-Mormon, and I respect everybody, whatever you've come up with. Christian, I respect that, but as an agnostic, I did this because I think the agnostic position is valid and doesn't get as much attention, enough attention, and that many of our most pressing religious cause problems in the world would be problematic if agnosticism were taking more seriously. And, you know, all you got to look is a couple of statistics to find out that it really is looked down, especially in this country. I think it's wrong that an atheist or an agnostic has virtually no chance of being successful, having a successful run at, for example, a public office in this country. I think it's a form of discrimination that's unwarranted. I think it's a form of discrimination that's unreasonable. And I think it's a form of discrimination that doesn't make any good sense. It needs to be eliminated. Much like the past discrimination of the blacks and the women's, I don't see it any differently. I think one of America's greatest strengths is separation of church and state. I feel blessed to live in this country because of that. I think many of the other countries looked at us and found out how well it worked, and that's why they're doing well also. I believe the system is currently under attack by a collection of radical Christian fundamentalists, often labeled as dominionists, the likes of the late Falwell, the current Robertsons and Dobsons, and worse, who want a legal system that favors Christianity and condemns and minimizes all of those of us who believe otherwise. Anything I can help to do to limit that, I want to do. Let me conclude by posing a few questions I pondered over and over again during my transformation from Mormon advocate to agnostic and give some of the answers I've come up with. First question, isn't religious direction from God necessary in order that people know the difference between right and wrong? Wouldn't it be utter chaos without that kind of supernatural moral compass for all of us? And my response is, I see no convincing evidence that God, if he, she, it exists, has ever communicated with man about anything, let alone what's right and wrong. The worthwhile moral codes that we might find in the Bible, the Torah, the Quran, were all man-made. So it is mankind himself who has developed our moral codes, no matter the source. right and wrong and the best way to treat each other is inborn in each of us, and I sort of am beginning to think that it's an evolutionary advantage that gives all of us a best chance of survival is to act like that towards our fellow men. The sad fact is that there have always been and there always will continue to be those who choose to act improperly for numerous reasons we could go into. But I think history has shown so far that it's going to happen just as often in a religious setting as otherwise. Some may credibly argue even more. This contention, I think, is reasonably arguable that the now famous quote by Nobel Prize-winning physicist Steven Weinberg may have been closer to the truth than many would like to think when he said, "Religion is an insult to human dignity. Organized religion is an insult to human dignity. Without it, you would have good people doing good things and evil people doing evil things. But for good people to do evil things, that takes religion." How does the subject of death enter into my present state of mind as it relates to agnosticism? First of all, as I've already mentioned and determined in my own mind, if there is a God, there isn't going to be a final judgment. Therefore, there can't be a heaven. Therefore, there can't be a hell. Therefore, there can't be a kingdom type of situation, even if there does end up being an afterlife of some kind. If there is an afterlife, I have absolutely no concern that I won't be treated any differently than anybody else, at least based on I feel I've been a pretty decent life up to this point. And any punishment we receive for our misdeeds is going... I've come to the conclusion that any punishment any punishment we're going to receive for our misdeeds is going to happen in this life. And it's going to, just as the way the world is and the way things have happened, it's going to be under the particular justice system that we're glad to be under, that we would not be glad to be under. It's just one of those things. Secondly, I hope I could, like everybody else, that I could reunite with those who I care about in some kind of afterlife. Again, though, this is just likely to happen with an atheist, with an agnostic, a deist, with a theist. I have no doubt about that either. Finally, I am fully prepared for the possibility that this life, whether there be a God or not, and I don't know how many of you thought about that, there could be a God and we're still not going anywhere after this life, is all there is for us. In that case, there's no use to fret about it. I feel real at ease with that now because none of us are going to know until it happens, and it's foolish to waste this life on worrying about something like that. I'm absolutely convinced from the evidence now available that there's currently, and this could change, agnostic, currently available, that we don't have an answer to whether what's going to happen. Okay, forget the question of death and afterlife. Isn't it possible you've screwed up me, this life, especially as it relates to my relationship with my family and others who now look down on me because of the position I've taken? That's a tough one. That's a fallout that has caused me, and I'm sure many of you, a lot of anxiety, and something I continue to work at. For example, I didn't tell my active daughters about the books I wrote. And that's kind of an interesting story because we'd moved away down to southern Utah, and one of the girls' best friends up here in Centerville, many years later, decided to want to look up one of my daughters, see how things were going. And so they Googled. Google just about killed me because when they Googled, they came up with my books. And the first thing the guy did was call one of my daughters and, "Did you know your dad's written two books?" And boy, did the you-know-what hit the you-know... I guess I can say fan. Yeah. But, you know, I had one of the best conversations with our two most active daughters after that. And we wrote emails. We talked on the phone for about an hour and a half. And I should have done it way sooner. Because by the time we got done, she was real upset. By the time we got done, she wasn't upset. We both agreed that you should still be able to have a loving family in close contact. And you should still, in each member of that family, be able to believe any way you want, and it shouldn't take away from that. Wonderful conversation. I don't know how I pulled it off. But I would rather live through that kind of challenge, because right now I feel much more contented than I did before. I think true contentment comes when we are true to ourselves and that we don't feel it necessary to accept any kind of dogma with which we feel uncomfortable and don't agree. Shouldn't have to do that, especially in America. Especially in a wonderful country like our founding fathers have set up for us. Okay, that's it. I'll finish with this. Okay, last question. One more question. What has ended up to be my primary goal? And I get this a lot of times for writing the two books. And I think I'd just like to summarize with this. By the way, if any of you want those, I bought a few extra. I'll sell them to you at cost out there if any of you are interested in them. But I want both Mormons and Christians of other denominations to at least respect the position of the agnostic point of view, even if they can't accept it. Also, that saying one isn't sure if there is a God or not shouldn't be considered all that unusual, and that there are credible reasons, at least, for taking that position. Let me close by stating the following conclusion that has become apparent to me, and that is, the truth is worth the struggle, and common sense and reason are two human signposts that should never be taken too lightly. Thank you.
It's good to be here. I want to thank everyone who is here supporting me and has been supporting me on the board when I came out in May. I came from a really dysfunctional background, a really kind of messed up family, and so Mormonism, as presented to me as a young teenager, had a lot of great appeal. It seemed to guarantee that I could create a kind of forever unit and overcome some of the challenges I'd had in my life, and it gave me a lot of rules that I could follow to make sure those things happened. So the stability came, but there was a high price with that, and that high price, and all of us here know what that price is, and that's we give up who we authentically are to follow those rules. And it's kind of ironic in a church that teaches this doctrine of free agency that we lose it by actually trying to do what the church tells us to do. I wasn't lukewarm either. I tried to do every single thing I could possibly do until I lost so great touch with myself that I didn't know who I was at all. And all I could do was use the control the church used on me on other people, and especially my husband, who has a much more firm sense of who he was and would not allow me to change him and remake him into the model Mormon man. He never was one to break out into song and say, "Let us gather as a family," and kneel in prayer. You know, he just didn't do all those things that I thought, this is what priesthood holders do. And so pressure and trying to get him to do those things, I had no control over my life, so I tried to control his. Anyway, we did leave the church together. And people have said, "Oh, that's so great you could leave together, you know, that you didn't struggle." But see, we did our struggle when I was trying to live the church. So we almost didn't make it. It was a really difficult time until when I was 37 years old, I crashed and burned. The depression was so severe, I ended up on medication and had a reaction and ended up in the hospital. And Bob McHugh said, seek professional help for your issues and things. And I would also say that is terrific advice, because that's when my healing began, when I actually got professional people to tell me, you're thinking in distorted ways, and you're codependent. And the church creates a distorted thinking and codependency. It creates that in us. And then addictions to control or whatever it is. It's impossible to do everything that we're supposed to do as Mormons, and I tried. I tried really hard and got to the point I couldn't think for myself. I tried, okay, Sabbath break. Okay, Sabbath. How can I keep the Sabbath better? I'd analyze. I mean, make a list. What could I do? Okay, I won't cook. I'll just heat up cans of soup. But one day I wanted cookies. And I thought, well, is that breaking the Sabbath to make cookies? That's how far I took it. And I asked my husband, who's much wiser than I am, you know, should I make cookies? It's work. He said, is it lawful to do good on the Sabbath? I made cookies. Anyway, so from that time when I began to let go of this distorted thinking, I noticed a shift in myself when things would come down through the church. And there's several of these I just want to list and then go into, you know, because this just gives you an example. I call it Gordon B. Hinckley's proclamation on the earlobe. When he came out with the, you know, a woman can only wear one modest pair of earrings, that was the first time I actually allowed myself to really feel anger at a church leader or at a prophet and say, who is this old man shaking his finger at me and telling me how I can wear my jewelry? This is ridiculous. This has nothing to do with spirituality. I've had these earrings for 20 years and I have to take them out. And I wasn't the only woman who was angry. There were a lot of angry sisters, and it was a big topic in Relief Society. I mean, imagine, we could be sitting there talking about really good things and we're just talking about our earlobes. Makes no sense. The next thing that happened is a teacher in Relief Society, I call it the manual, the whole manual, and nothing but the manual. Notice there's no truth in there. And it was Brigham Young. That was the manual. And we got an edict from our Relief Society counselor that we were to not use any additional materials except what was in the manual. That's all we could use. And not only could we just use the manual, we could only use what was for that particular lesson, including the noted scriptures. I wasn't allowed anymore to search my scriptures and be inspired to use anything unless it was in that chapter. And it really, really made me mad. And I wasn't the only one. I sat in a Relief Society leadership meeting, and I saw women about in tears because they felt like they had just been neutered in their ability to do anything, independent thought at all. So, but I complied. I complied with these things. The next thing that happened where I allowed myself to be angry was what I call force-fed enrichment. We all know we had homemaking meeting, and then they changed it to personal home and family enrichment night. And we couldn't even call it enrichment night. It had to be called the full name because that was what Salt Lake said we had to do. But in our stake, they didn't like the attendance at this meeting. They wanted us to be there. And so they sent a letter to every single sister in the entire stake, even if they were inactive and no contact sisters. They got a letter informing them it was their duty and requirement to attend enrichment night. You will come to enrichment night. You will not use the church as a buffet or a salad bar. And I thought, okay, so what does that mean? You're going to force feed us? Is the church a feedlot? Now I'm locked in a fence. I'm force-fed, awaiting slaughter of my authentic self. That's how it felt to me. And so these things just keep happening, and pretty soon it just starts to unravel for me. And I just thought, you know, this is not right. I'm losing who I am. I fought so hard to get myself back, and I'm not going to give up who I am. And I thought it was so ironic, again, with the agency. The church is, you know, we're told, well, we're here that we should have joy. And yet, what can suck joy faster away than the church? Just couldn't believe it. And so, so I started to distance myself from the church, and I started to enrich myself. I started to read things that I was interested in, things the church would not approve of. And to the point I got a little bit nervous because I sort of felt myself kind of falling away. And I lost fear. I lost fear of reading things, and I had more love for people of all persuasions and ideas. And my husband is sort of witnessing this process. And after church one day, another miserable day at church where I would go and read in my car during Relief Society because I just got to where I couldn't even handle that meeting at all. I told my husband, I said, I'm reading things that I shouldn't probably be reading. And I think I could leave the church. And he said, Nanette, I'll never tell you what to read, what you can read, what to believe or feel or believe or think. I may not agree. And so right then I felt, okay, that little last amount of fear had left me, and I felt I could really start to really search. And as a teenager joining the church, I was given certain select information and told that I should not seek any additional resources. And that was a rule I could follow, and I did follow it. But now I'm like, no, I want to look at everything that I didn't look at before. So I started to look at things, but another thing that happened was my son was reaching mission age. And so we filled his papers out, honestly. My son has Asperger's, which is an autism spectrum disorder. He's very high functioning. Most people wouldn't even know he has the issue. He traveled to Greece as a caretaker for the environment and made a presentation in Greece. He was an academic all-star at his high school and received a scholarship. He's a great kid. So we filled out the papers and didn't think there would be a problem. The call did come, but it came from our stake president who said, Salt Lake. And who is Salt Lake? Salt Lake wanted more information. They wanted to speak with my son and find out, you know, more about his condition and you know, just, like, make sure he could maybe carry on a conversation or whatever. So I took my son to meet with a social worker from LDS Social Services. And the man, the first thing he said was, where's your husband? I said, what do you mean? You're going to talk to my son, right, about his mission? Oh, no. This is about your whole family. And they proceeded to put our entire family under a microscope. They wanted to know all of our mental health history. Had we had marital difficulties? If we had depression, was it chemical or was it situational? What about your parents? Any mental health problems there? Well, I do have mental health issues with my father. And I thought, I can't give this information. Maybe my son won't be allowed to serve a mission. And I felt by the end of this, I felt like I had been splayed and gutted. And I never, it just shifted in me so much, the church, the power it has over us to bring up things that, I mean, had nothing to do with my son serving a mission, but because they said, this is what you're going to do, well, you're going to obey and you're going to do it. My son went out into the field. I continued to read and explore and enrich myself using my independent sources of information and things that make me happy. And my son's letters started to be very strange. Obedience. Mother is the most important thing I can give to God. It's the only thing he doesn't have, and he requires it of me, and I must give it to him. And I thought, oh my gosh, he's sounding like some brainwashed zombie boy. What is going on? And I talked to my husband. He goes, yeah, they do that to you on a mission. It's how they keep these kids in control. But he'll get home and we'll take care of it. I didn't like it. I didn't like it at all. So we get an email from our son that his knee has been injured. And we're like, wow, has he seen a doctor? And the emails, this is it. You can only get an email or a letter once a week, and you can only talk to them twice a year. I'll tell you right now, someone in prison has more communication privileges than someone on a mission. When I came in to the airport, I saw an elder returning from his mission and everyone crying and grabbing him, and I thought, he's just been released from prison. No wonder they're so happy. Because it is honestly this isolation and then this, I think that the mission process is designed to get you fully automated into the church program. So you come back, you do your job, and you continue to build whatever it is they're trying to build. I was going to say kingdom, but you know what? It's just a perverted system. It creates so much instability in a person. You don't know who you are. I mean, you want to know who you are? You go ask the church. Have them looking up at the handbook and tell you who you are. So my son hurt his knee. We get these emails. He's injured. It's swollen up twice its size. He said, my mission president looked at it. He said it's going to be okay. His mission president's an eye doctor, so I assume he'll be able to see out of his knee fine for the rest of his life. My husband says, call that mission president and talk with him. I just got another email. It's been 3 weeks. This knee's not getting better. He needs to see a doctor. So I call the mission president, who's very irritated to be talking to me, some woman, questioning his medical diagnosis as an eye doctor. And I had to argue with him to have my son see a physician. And I couldn't even believe it. He has my son away from me. My son's hurt, and he needs to see a doctor. And he finally said, well, you know, if he goes to the doctor and they find something, I'll send him home. And I was thinking, do it, make my day, send him home. Well, he didn't need to send him home. At this point, I was so disgusted with the church, I thought, you know what, I'm going to really see if I can find other people who feel like I feel. And I got online, and I did find other people. I found the New Order Mormons, and I thought, that's what I am. I'm a New Order Mormon. I didn't even know it. I didn't even know there was such a thing. I'll just go to church and choose what to believe and not to believe and do what I want to do and not want to do. And then I thought, why would I do that? Why would I do that? If I don't believe it, why would I keep doing it? So then I found the Recovery from Mormonism board, and I just feasted on that, and I sat over my keyboard and wept and gnashed my teeth and cried. It was hell to read the things that had been hidden from me. I felt deceived. I was angry. How could I have been a member of this church for all these years and not known these things? How could these things be hidden from the membership? Why are these things hidden from the membership? And I decided I'd go in and tell my husband. And he'd say, well, you're just trying to find negative things about the church. And I said, no, I'm investigating it with all the information. If you can't talk to me about it and I can't talk to you about it, I'll find someone else to talk to. The next morning he apologized to me, and I felt relief that we could at least discuss the things I was finding out. So had anybody played that game Kerplunk when you were a kid? It's a plastic tube and has little straws in it. You dump the marbles on the top, and the straws support the marbles. Well, I was playing a game of Kerplunk with the church. You pull those little straws out, and you just try to keep those marbles in place. And I've been playing that for quite a while. But finally, the last straw. I read Tal Bachman's post on the Mormon Mall project. How many billions of dollars are they spending on this mall? And I want to know, what does Jesus need a mall for? You know? And I thought, okay, this is ridiculous. And then the next morning I got an email from my son saying his budget for food had been cut from $145 a month to $130 a month that he was expected to eat on $130 a month and also buy the supplies for his apartment and his personal hygiene. And I thought, that's it. I'm done. I'm out of here. I wrote a letter to my husband, 11 pages. I gave it to him. He said, no pictures? I'm like, come on, grow up, read my letter. And I left. I went and bought some really cute, fun underwear. And it was just like, wow, I can feel the breeze on my back. It was great. And the next day, my husband called a family meeting and said, Mom's leaving the church. She's farther in her research process than I am, but I think I want to let everyone know. And they're like, what about Tyler? What do we do about our brother? And he goes, I'm thinking about that. During this time, I came out on the board as Amazing Grace, and people had a hard time believing my story, I guess. And I understand it now, why it would be hard to believe. But I did receive support there, and I received some really good information that I was able to share with my husband. Diane Ormond has a wonderful four-page exit letter that she sent me, and it had references to everything, and I gave that to my husband along with some other materials people had shared with me. And he spent about 2 hours reading that, and he came out to the table on a Saturday morning, and he said, just want to let you guys know we're leaving the church, and we're going to be much, much better people for it. He said, you know, Heavenly Father, God, or whatever's out there has to love all his children the same. And, you know, being a Mormon, you know, that is not the end-all be-all. That there's a lot more to this life than this religious doctrine and dogma, and we're gonna drop it, and we're gonna move forward. And then he looked at me and says, what do we do about our boy? And I said, well, let's go get him. So I packed up my underwear and I got tickets, and we flew to North Carolina. We left within like 4 hours. We were on a plane. We tried to contact our son to maybe let him know. We didn't want to scare him or shock him, but you know what? We're not allowed to have his phone number. We tried to find it through members that he had listed. No one had the number. We couldn't call him. And then in the end, we thought, you know, it's probably better that we surprise him, because if they get wind, they could move him, and we wouldn't be able to find him. So we got to North Carolina, rented a car, we drove to his chapel, and we sat out there, and it was just really great, because we'd talked to him at Mother's Day. I knew what kind of car I was driving, I knew where his chapel was, I knew what time church meant. I had all this good information from my Mother's Day call. And we're waiting out there, and he came out, and he's like, and he said, he almost said to the Word mission leader, that guy looks just like my dad. And then the thought went through his mind, that is my dad. That is my mom. They are here to tell me they're leaving the church. He must have picked it up through my letters. I hate the church, I hate the church, I hate the church. I was more subtle than that. I told him not to judge the guys with dreadlocks down to their hips. He was in the hills. He had a lot of redneck hillbillies, and he sent home some interesting pictures. So he had 7 months there, exposure to all the kinds of different things. It was good. So we approached him. First he tried to get in his car and drive away because it's against the rules to talk to us. So his dad's like, stop. Tyler, wait. So we had a conversation, and we asked if we could speak with him alone. And the Word mission leader hung out with his companion, and we went to a room and spoke with him for about an hour. And we didn't know if he was going to come home with us. We bought a ticket for him. We, of course, couldn't force him to come home. But we talked with him, and we said we found out some things about the church that concern us. We found out there's a much different history to this religion than what we've taught you, and we feel bad that we didn't give you the right information, and you're out here teaching it. We want you to know we are leaving, and we would like you to come home with us and go through this process with us. And he said, I can't do that. I can't leave. We have some materials for you to look at. I can't do that. Against rules. Only read 4 books. They're only allowed to read 4 books on their mission. He said, I thought I'd get to read the Journal of Discourses out here. I said, oh, no. That's the last thing they want you reading on your mission. Anyway, we finally were able to convince him to come home. It was kind of an interesting... I don't know why this happened. I don't know how. I mean, I have very different beliefs now from when I left the church. I've pretty much dismantled Christianity with the same critical thinking skills I use with the church. And you know, but at that time, I mean, you call prayer prayer or whatever. I mean, there's something that helps me. I don't know what it is, but it helps me. And I asked for its help. I asked my son to have a dream that somehow he would know he could come home. And my husband had asked the same thing, independent. We didn't get 2 seats on the plane together, so we were actually asking the same thing. And my son did have a dream and related it to us. And he said, we said, what do you think it means? He goes, well, I think it means I'm coming home. Basically, he's in a forest that looks like North Carolina, and it changes to home, changes to the Oregon forest. So he knew he should come home. We called the mission president, and the mission president was like, did you get permission from your stake president to do this? My husband said, you know, we don't need permission to talk to our son. So it's the hardest thing I ever did, to ask my son to leave his mission. He was 3 years old when he told the bishop, Bishop, I want to go on a mission. And I told the bishop, I didn't pay him to say that. I've never even really talked about it. I don't know where he got that, but he wanted to go. And to ask him to leave was the hardest thing I ever did. And taking him back to the mission president and dropping that companion off, it was just the most painful, horrible thing I've ever done in my life. It was awful. But as we got further away and we were able to talk with him, he started to open up and say, you know, I've just relied on your testimony. It didn't make sense to me, but I thought it would in time. And isn't that the same with all of us? We're relying on other people, It doesn't work. So we said, hey, we're coming clean. He came clean. The next day was P-Day. We spent that in North Carolina looking at everything that he'd experienced there. We got him home. We told him, look at it, and if you want to go back, we'll send you back to the mission. And we're like, that's not happening once he sees what we show him. I thought it might take him, you know, 2 weeks. It took him 1 day. Garments off in the garbage can. Smart kid, has a high IQ. He figured it out really fast. Then came the meeting with the stake president. Oh, I have to say, when we were at his mission apartment packing him up and cleaning it and noticing that there were no cleaning supplies and very little food, but, you know, they're living on $130 a month, our stake president somehow had the phone number for that apartment. Isn't that amazing? I didn't have that phone number, but he had it, and he called and said, hey, guys, what are you doing? What's going on? I just saw you last weekend. What's going on? And we said, well, we need to bring our son home and talk with him. We have some things going on with our family. Well, come and talk to me about it. So we came home Tuesday evening, and the appointment with him was Thursday morning. And we knew that we would be in a lot of trouble for what we did. And so we had our resignation letter ready. We weren't waiting for any discipline action. We like beat him to the punch. And it was a sad thing. Our stake president's a good man. And it brought him to about tears when my husband and son went in there and gave him the resignation for our entire family of 8. And I'll tell you, when those letters came, we got our letters from Dodge. They must have a machine printing them so fast they don't even have time to dry before the next one hits, because the ink was spread, like, all over them. I just can see this thing just spitting these things out. You just imagine that. It's just spitting them out. There's a lot of people leaving the church. It's great. Anyway, so we're home, and we've submitted our resignation, and I thought, you know, I better let people know. I mean, I was a teacher in religious study. My husband had taught high priest the week before. How does this happen? How does the family just leave all of a sudden? And instead of letting the rumor mill take it over, and somebody said the rumor mill would be going faster than a religious study wheat grinder, and I believe it. I wrote a letter, and it had a cover letter on it. And that cover letter was to protect anyone who didn't want to hear my story or know why we left, because I didn't want to assault anyone. Mormonism works for a lot of people on some levels. And I figure I stayed in as long as I needed to, and when I didn't need to, I got out. And I didn't want to hurt anybody, really. So I sent a letter to about 60-some people telling them why we left and leaving it up to them if they wanted to know for themselves so that they could have, you know, the true story of what really happened. I don't think it did any good. I think that they're making up their own reasons for why we left. I find it amazing that I was allowed to chaperone a trip to a general conference last year, but then now our bishop's reporting to people that we're living a lifestyle non-conducive to the church, and that's why we left. Except I never remember being talked to about what it was I was doing that was so bad. Anyway, we're out. Oh, thinking, yeah, I know, you know, since I've left the church, I have all this time to polish my horns, trim my cloven hooves, and groom my long forked tail. You know, and what am I guilty of? Using my own brain and defining who I am for myself. And that's pretty much my story. My family's doing well. It's been an adjustment, but we're doing well, and we're in this process. It's not over yet. We're still growing and developing, and I really appreciate all of your stories, because it was your stories that gave me the courage to get out. I sat there for weeks reading these things, reading your stories and your sacrifices. I know it costs us so much when we leave. There's so many different levels that we pay on, but it's worth it. The price of staying is so much higher, and I want to thank you all for your courage and inspiring me to be able to do what I did.
I'm going to ask the first one. Nanette was in my sister's ward. My sister and brother-in-law were friends with them. And I just wanted to know, do they ask your kids to babysit anymore?
Initially, yes. It was really interesting. My kids have been just love-bombed to death since we left. I mean, really, my husband and I are the evil ones. The kids are just the innocent bystanders. Mm-hmm. So they've been treated really well. They've been called by adults to go do things with them, and it really hasn't affected them a whole lot as far as their treatment, which has been really good. I mean, we actually, people have been really kind to the kids, and they work in a store where they see Mormons every single day.
Hi, Nanette. This is Amber. I pulse this Tom Thummim. I have been following your story from day one, and I just commend you for your courageousness and integrity. I wanted to ask just an update to your story. You were moving, or you decided not to?
We thought it would really be good to have a fresh start and to move. Does this need to be closer, or am I okay? Am I okay? Can you hear me? Okay. So we attempted to sell our house, and we fixed it up really nice to make it sellable. Did a lot of things to it that we hadn't taken the time to do for ourselves, and we didn't sell it. So now we're sitting there, and it's all nice and fixed up. And actually, I'm, like, really glad that we didn't move. For one thing, it kept our house payment lower, which is good, because now I'm going to school, which is something I've wanted to do. I mean, I've stayed home.
My question is, follow-up to the house, in the first while that you left, you were posting, if I remember correctly, that you'd run into people at the grocery store or friends, and they were treating you, or at least the facade of treating you nice, and I was jealous of that, because I got the polar opposite experience, and I was thinking, what is she doing that I'm not doing?
And I just saw that movie. What was it? I'm trying to remember. But anyway, Minnesota Nice is the thing I'm talking about here. It's like people are nice and smile, but, you know, the fear is glazed over their eyes. They don't really want to talk to me. And people who were really my friends I had relationships with, they've had no contact with me. I had maybe 4 or 5 people respond to me from my letter and say, you know, I love you no matter what. I don't know why you left. It doesn't matter to me. I still love you. One of those people is my former visiting teacher who still comes every month. And she's the stake president's wife and the young women's president. You know, she loves our family. She cares about us. It was a totally unexpected thing for them. I don't think most people have processed really what happened. And in our own family, my brother and sister-in-law refused to respond to any emails for over 3 months, and then when they did, it was really, really mean. So it's nothing you've done. It's just people's different reactions. Most people avoid me. They don't want to talk to me. I mean, it's like we're all, as Mormons, we're wearing sweaters with a big snag hanging off, and someone might grab that and run. And what are you going to be left with? They don't want you anywhere near them. You might grab that snag.
Hi, Nanette.
Hi.
I followed you the whole time on RFM. I'm Jack Mormon's wife.
Yes.
Shannon.
Okay.
Yeah.
Hi.
And I kind of babysat your teenage daughter. She got overwhelmed
yes,
with caring for all the kids.
Yes.
And my teenage girls feel the same way when I leave them with all the little ones.
Yeah.
So I was keeping her calm. And I just want to know how she's doing, and also how is Tyler? How is he adjusted?
They're doing really well. It's been hard. Tyler, he's 20. He doesn't really want to be home with his younger siblings. It's noisy, and as a person with Asperger's, he hates noise. It just bothers him. We gave him his own room, the quietest place in the house. He's in school. He's doing electronics technology. He really likes it. He's working at a Fred Meyer down the hill from us, and he's at school and working, and he's doing great. It's just the angst that you would normally have at this age. You know, he's dealing with that. But, we're just trying to support him and help him the best we can. I mean, we're also just, this is a new thing. I think he's an atheist. He has no need for religion. He wants nothing to do with God. He doesn't believe anything. I think he'll in time maybe, build that basis with more information. But for now, he's just like, you know what, I'm not going to be duped again. This is ridiculous. I won't do it. So he's doing well. And my daughter is in school as well. She's finished massage school. I think that was part of our alternative bad lifestyle, that my daughter went to massage school. Yeah. I can't figure out what exactly we did that was so bad now that they're spreading these rumors that we just, you know, we had an alternative lifestyle. I'd like to know what that means. But she's doing well. I think the biggest problem with the kids, and they've all kind of expressed this, is that they miss the activities. They do miss the activities. So we've been trying to, you know, supplement other types of things. But it is a hole. It leaves a hole in their life. They were used to the different things that they got to do through church.
Hey, I had a question. You mentioned something when you left about they gave you a letter. Okay, because, like, I've been trying to leave the church, and I've sent several different resignation letters and had to go back again and again, and they keep stalling and hemming and hawing. And the last time I had to write 2 copies of my latest letter to both the stake president and the bishop, it was a couple months ago, and they said, all right, here's the deal. Within 30 days, we'll wait, and then if you don't rescind your request, then you'll automatically be dropped from the list of members and you won't be a member anymore. But I'm just kind of wondering, how can you tell for sure that they're telling the truth? I mean, they never sent me a letter.
I got a really nice letter from Brother Dodge. 8 of them. You know, I'm taking his word for it. You know, I mean, for me, it's a symbolic thing. I understand they count me anyway, you know, and they can go ahead and count me, but I know I'm not part of it, and I have a letter. And, resignation for me was I needed to take that step. I could have just drifted off into an activity, but getting the son out of the mission field, that wasn't going to allow me just to drift off. I mean, that was kind of like we were going to have a problem with that, so we had to resign. And it happened real quick. I don't know why. I mean, our letter was like, we don't want a 30-day period. You know, I went and used the model letters. I used Diane's letter and some other letters that are available online to model our letter, to make it real clear. And then when my stake president got the stuff from Salt Lake, he called, "Hey, Nanette, just wanted to make sure you really, 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 really want to still do this." I'm like, "Yep." He goes, "Okay, well, if you ever change your mind, you can come back." And I'm thinking, nope. Yeah, like I want to pay tithing again and put on garments. Uh-uh.
Ray, I wanted to ask you, you have five daughters?
Yes.
Now, are some of them out of the church or none of them out of the church?
When I got into this about 1993, we probably had two that were real active, one on the border, and two that weren't active at all.
Oh, really?
And so, of course, when it all came about, then the biggest problem was with the two that were really active. And now the one that was kind of on the border has become active.
Ew.
but she understands, because I had all kinds of trouble with her when I was active and she wasn't, so it's fair play. But anyway, like I said, I'm on real good terms with both daughters now. They both really felt some deep feelings that I should have talked to them far sooner than I did. And after we had these good conversations, we're fine now. And the only trouble is, you know, when you got going on your 11th grandkid and they won't let you in the circle, or you can't go into the temple for your daughter's ceremonies and things, that's awful tough on me. And my mom, who really won't discuss it with me, I'll go to a church where they're blessing them that day, and she'll say, "Raymond, why aren't you standing up there with the..." And then everybody can hear, you know. But anyway.
So how do the siblings, second part of the question is, the siblings who are out, how what's their relationship with your daughters who are still active?
You know, we all get along real well as a family and don't seem to blame each other for whatever it is, and they're on the phone almost constantly, all five of them, with my wife. They never want to talk to me. But with my wife, on a daily basis, we're on Verizon, and that thing is just going from morning till night.
Ray, I just had a question with your wife, what her status is right now and how you have been able to keep your marriage alive through this whole process.
Yeah, I think she's a little bit worried, and that maybe, you know, it was like, you want to have these things, keep them to yourself, but why in the world do you think you need to publish books about it? You know, just better to keep it a little more low-key than that. You're just causing trouble you don't need to cause yourself. And I think, you know, that's a little bit of a problem. And I've submitted my letter, but she has not submitted her letter. And so, but she's not active in the church at all either. So, you know, it's a little bit of tension, but we both love each other very much, and none of this is going to affect our marriage or the way we feel about each other. But it's not, you know, it's not, we're not both completely on the same page. Almost, but not completely. So I don't know how that'll play in the future.
I actually came because I'm a near and dear friend of Nanette, but I'm very glad that Mr. Holt is here. I have a question. You mentioned the legal and political agenda as far as religion getting involved. Do you see anything locally that you could speak to as far as LDS thought influencing the legal or political?
Well, you know, I mean, a lot of things bother me on separation of church and state. I just got back from a two-week trip to, we stayed in Williamsburg, Virginia, and went through Washington, D.C., and I've been studying real carefully our founding fathers and exactly what it was that their religious beliefs were and what they wanted as far as our Constitution. So I get kind of upset with separation of church and state. Like McCain said the other day, I can't remember where he said it, but yes, this is true. Our nation was founded to be a Christian nation, which is couldn't be any farther from the truth that anybody understands any reading at all of Washington, of Jefferson, of Hamilton, of any of those people. That you know, that was the farthest. Even though some of them were religious themselves, the last thing they wanted is to combine religion and the government. And so, I mean, even things like Voucher. This might be nitpicking a little bit, but I really don't want any public money going in a private school where, you know, it could be religious overtones. How are you going to control it? So that bothers me for that reason. Those type of things are bothering me every day. And I hear from these Dominionists, and it's, boy, they've got an agenda going, and I think Bush has hurt them terribly. But, you know, it's still a danger out there, and the great country that this is not going to be great if all of a sudden another Supreme Court justice or two are Dominionists. Then we're in real big trouble, because there's going to go Roe versus Wade. There's going to go, you know, religion in the schools. It's going to be, we're going to be in real trouble. So hopefully we'll get a Democratic alternative to that this
Ray?
Next election.
Ray? Most of us have looked into Joseph Smith, but as an FBI agent for as many years as you were in, what did you see as an FBI agent that caused you to question Joseph Smith?
Well, I mean, I guess you could read my book, but because I devote almost every chapter as to something that he did that was a con man and a fraud, and the more I did, the more chapters I did, the more that became painfully evident. And, at first I just didn't like things like when we were in San Francisco, I had a black brother that couldn't hold the priesthood. That bothered me, you know, and polygamy I could never see any value to. And then as I just started taking it one at a time, you know, the temple ceremony, that to me was gruesome. It's changed a lot now. People that go to the temple now have no idea what it used to be like in the old days when we used to go, or what it used to be even worse before I started going. And, of course, you know, things like how can that be if this comes from God, that this is a temple ceremony from God. He doesn't have to have things change every 5 or 10 years to make sure he keeps the membership active. And so it just, you know, and then the Lamanite thing. And, it just started compounding itself. But I tell you what, if we had a court, the evidence would be there. It wouldn't take long. There'd be no jury, I can imagine, that would have any problem with it.
I just had one comment and a question. The comment was to the gal over here. You do get a letter, and you get a please come back pamphlet. At the same time, you get the letter. It's an amazing marketing strategy. But the other piece on that is they still pursue my daughter, which is very fascinating. So they have respected and taken us off the rolls, but they will come for your children still, and I find that kind of interesting. My question is to Ray. I find it fascinating that I was raised Mormon and that a lot of people who leave Mormonism can't find something else typically in the Christianity family. It's not uncommon to hear them go completely to the agnostic point of view. And I don't see that with other Christian faiths. They can fall from Catholicism to, you know, Episcopalian or something. And just because I find it unusual, you wrote books on both areas, and they obviously have some kind of a fit for you, and I'd be interested in your thoughts on that.
Yeah, you know, I can only speak for myself, and I certainly don't want to criticize anybody else that's found, a good life with another Christian faith, because I respect that. I really do, if that's what you found. It's just something personal with me. I started finding too many things like I did with in the Bible, like I had with the Book of Mormon and Joseph Smith, that just didn't ring true. And of course, you're taking it wrong. This is just an allegory. This is just that and all that, but you know, after a while, I just found too many things. So for me personally, and not making any offense to anybody else, believe me, that was just what I came up with. And so right now, I'm just saying I don't know. Bible could be end up, evidence comes along. Jesus Christ could have been born of a virgin, could have been resurrected. Give me the evidence, and then I'll maybe change from an agnostic to a theist. But until that happens, I just don't see it.
We just never have enough time, but I appreciate so much you coming and sharing both your stories. Matt, are we ready to go with the DVD? Huh? You can go potty. They're not going potty. Okay. We are not going to take a break. If you have to go, do it quietly. I'm going to turn the time over to our president, Sandy, to tell you just a very short little bit about our DVD, and then we will show it to you. We hope you're as excited about it as we are. We've already had lots of requests for it. It will be for sale afterwards, and she'll tell you about that. But let's should we give them 5 minutes? 5 minutes. Run quick.